Arizona is back in the spotlight after votes this week in the state legislature on a religious freedom bill. All this attention worries some that it's deja vu all over again.
It's very bad press for the state. It looks terrible to other people.
I'm Mark Brodine. Today on the show is Senate Bill 1062, the new Senate Bill 1070. Also, ridiculously fast internet could be coming to the Valley. We'll hear from the first city to land Google Fiber. A major Valley grocer is thinking about selling, and that could lower your food bills. And Phoenix's new city manager on the challenges facing our city and his 20 years in city government.
I hope it sends a signal that people can make a meaningful career in serving the public in public service.
Plus, an historic resort is taking your bid and another tick on the Phoenix bucket list. That and more ahead on the show after a check of this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Dozens of Ukrainian police officers defect and are met with cheers at Kiev's Independence Square, a stark contrast from this week's explosive clashes between police and protesters that began as largely peaceful demonstrations nearly 3 months ago. This has been a day of sweeping political change in Ukraine. President Viktor Yanukovych signed a pact with opposition leaders to surrender some of his powers, form a national unity government, and to hold a presidential vote earlier than planned. But NPR Saraya Sarhadi-Nelson says there's still a lot of skepticism that the deal today will stick.
Given the mood in the square and the people that I've spoken to, they are not willing to believe that this is over. I mean, for them, they want to see Yanukovych and the government resign. So it's really not clear that the terms of this deal are actually going to be met.
NPR Saraya Sarhadi-Nelson in Kiev. Still, the West views today's developments as a good sign. President Obama praised the deal brokered by European foreign ministers in Ukraine. Russia, Yanukovych's ally, took part in the talks, didn't sign on, though. NPR's Michelle Kellerman reports Obama called his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, to talk about that.
White House spokesman Jay Carney says the U.S. and Russia do have shared stakes in Ukraine.
It is in Russia's interest for the violence to end in Ukraine, as it is in the interest of the United States and our European friends, and of course, most importantly, the Ukrainian people.
Carney says the U.S. welcomes the agreement between Ukraine's President Viktor Yanukovych and opposition leaders to hold early elections and revert to a previous constitution with more limits on the president's power. Ukrainian officials blamed for this week's violence have been barred from traveling to the U.S., and Carney says the U.S. could still impose targeted sanctions if there's further violence. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, Washington.
Now on to Sochi, Russia, where the first doping cases of the 2014 Winter Games have been reported. NPR's Sam Sanders says one case involves a German athlete who tested positive for a stimulant.
Germany's Olympic Committee says they were told Thursday that one of their Olympians had tested positive. They were notified by the International Olympic Committee. According to the German Ski Federation, a second test taken on the athlete also came back positive. Also today, a bobsledder from Italy was kicked out of the games for doping. The International Olympic Committee said it had planned to carry out more than 2,400 drug tests in Sochi, a record for Winter Olympics, and a 57% increase from the 2010 Winter Games. If a medalist tests positive for a banned substance, their win will be revoked. A few weeks ago, a Russian biathlete withdrew from the games before they even started, after she failed the drug test. Sam Sanders, NPR News, Sochi.
Before the closing bell, Dow was down 30 points at 16,103. NASDAQ was off 5 and the S&P 500 down 4 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs and their innovations to solve the world's most pressing problems at skoll.org. This is KJZZ.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody. Steve Goldstein is away, and let's get to it.
Sometimes one person's freedom is another's repression. Case in point, an Arizona bill that would let businesses actually refuse to serve certain people if they claim that serving them would violate their religious beliefs. Well, the measure cleared the legislature and is sitting on the governor's desk.
That from CNN this morning. Arizona back in the national spotlight based on something going on at the Capitol. I'm joined now by KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. And Jude watched yesterday's debate, three-something hours of it in the House.
Yeah, it took a while yesterday. It was pretty passionate on both sides.
It already had cleared the state Senate. CNN mentioned, it will be heading to the governor next. So, Jude, sum up the arguments for us, both pro and con, on this bill.
Well, the backers of the bill cite a case that happened in New Mexico where it was possible for a photographer to be sued when she refused to photograph a same-sex commitment ceremony. And so they wanted a bill that would allow a protection, a legal defense, to be used in court to so that businesses here would know that they wouldn't have to violate their own religious beliefs. On the other side, Democrats were saying, well, that sounds a lot like creating a second-class people who won't be allowed to get services. And that sounds like state-sanctioned discrimination. So that was the debate.
What are we hearing from business leaders around Arizona about the fact that this is what people are seeing about Arizona right now?
Right. You know, the image of the state is really in question here, according to business leaders. There's a lot of concern that this could be SB 1070 all over again, the same kind of backlash and boycotts that we saw following the 2010 legislation passing. So, you know, I talked with Barry Broom, who's the CEO and president of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council. And this has happened so fast, we're already seeing an impact. He's very concerned about this. His council has asked the governor to veto this bill. And here he is talking about some of the calls he got last night.
We had four separate calls from companies, of which we were on a short list to open offices and invest people. Something I'm talking about, you know, I'm talking about a few thousand jobs. These weren't small investments. One company that dropped us this morning was going to invest or considering investing over 1,000 jobs. And the HR director of the company told me and the CEO that they could not in good conscience relocate people from where they are today into this market. And they already had concerns about us because some of the past attitudes that they've seen come out from a policy perspective.
That was Barry Broom, president and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council. Jude, what are we hearing from other business folks?
So far we haven't heard as vocal of an outcry from any of the other Phoenix area groups. The Phoenix Chamber hasn't taken a position yet. But so we'll see. Broom seemed to think that we would be hearing more of an outcry as the days go by. He pointed out that this is still very new. But I think this will really be a critical point as to what the governor does next, is really how loud these business voices are. Could play a very big role in persuading her to veto it.
KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block. Jude, thanks.
Thank you.
Negative publicity, whether from the Capitol or elsewhere, is always a concern for officials in one of Arizona's biggest industries, tourism. Kathleen Anderek studies tourism at ASU and says bad news is bad for the industry.
People don't want to go to places if they think the people who live there are bigots. I mean, to be perfectly honest, and that's the way this appears to be to people, to the outside communities and, you know, in other states and other countries.
I'm joined now by Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services, who was at the Capitol for yesterday's debate. And Howie, is there in any way a comparison in mood, expectation, or pretty much anything else between this week's vote on the religion bill and other bills that have put Arizona in the national news, like SB 1070?
Well, there's one key difference with Senate Bill 1070, and when I was talking with Barry Brooms, as was Jude, he said, look, we could tell businesses there was a reason for 1070. We have an immigration problem here, and this was our effort to solve it, good, bad, or indifferent. We don't have a quote-unquote gay problem. It's not like gays are marching into bakeries all over Phoenix and saying, you will bake us a gay wedding cake. And so he said, that's part of the reason that we are going and urging the governor to kill this, because the only message he said this sends when it's CNN and MSNBC and the Wall Street Journal is that Arizona is hostile to gays. So this one clearly is of a different tenor.
Do we have any sense of what the governor might do on this one?
Well, you know, she's in Washington for the National Governors Association. In fact, the bill isn't even on her desk yet. She's going to get it on Monday, and then she'll have 5 days to decide what to do. On one hand, This is a governor who is deeply religious. I heard her several years ago speak to a group of Lutheran ministers about bringing faith into government and using faith as part of governing. On the other hand, you've got two other factors at work. One, of course, is this business development. This is the time this governor is looking at her legacy, and her legacy in some ways is, quote, the Arizona comeback. If this suddenly leads to businesses canceling coming here, if we don't get Google Fiber, if Apple says, well, you know, we're really not that interested, that undermines that. The second thing, which is a little more political, is this bill is being pushed by Kathy Herod of the Center for Arizona Policy. And while the governor in the past has sided with CAP, Herod sort of stabbed the governor in the back a little bit last year in terms of the Medicaid expansion bill and tried to get some abortion language in there the governor didn't want. So that relationship is a little bit frayed, too. Do you lay money on it one way or the other? That's a good way to lose money. But I think that there's a good case to be made that the governor may say, look, we don't have a problem here. One of the interesting things is for all the talk, including our own stories, that this allows businesses to turn away gays. You can already do that in Arizona. Gays are not a protected class in Arizona, you know, unlike, you know, race, religion, national origin, gender. And so if somebody says, I don't serve gays, they want to put a sign on their door, they're free to do that. So the question for the governor may be, what problem are we solving here?
And that of course, is another question about cities like Phoenix, which do include same-sex or homosexuals and transgendered people in their anti-discrimination laws. Howie Fisher is Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Phoenix's new city manager is someone who's familiar with both the job and the city government in general. Ed Zuercher had been at the acting city manager since October and has worked for the city for around two decades. He says there are a bunch of big issues with which he'll be dealing.
You know, the city has a budget deficit, and I've talked with you before about that we are identifying somewhere around the $40 million range. So that is the most immediate thing we have on our plate. We're also in the middle of negotiating contracts with our seven labor unions and organizations. And then, of course, there's also longer-term things we want to be looking at, which is how to continue to provide really great services to our community and keep our employees energized in doing that. And that's a whole issue of technology is also with us, and in our city's infrastructure, our streets and our transit, and keeping those things up to par.
How much do you expect to continue or diverge from the style, the way that things were done from your predecessor?
Well, my predecessor was a good city manager. He did a lot of great things for the city, and I learned a lot from David. But as you imply, I am my own person, and I really like to focus on our employees and helping them do their jobs better. We have great employees at the city who really care. And I think one of the main things a city manager can do is to help engage and energize those employees to provide better and better services at a lower cost.
This is a city council that is not unanimous on everything by a long shot. Was it meaningful to you to have a unanimous vote to name you the new city manager?
Oh, absolutely. I'm very grateful to the mayor and the city council for that support. And I don't think it's a bad thing that the mayor and the council aren't always unanimous on things. I think that's a reflection of our community, and that's why they get elected, is to reflect our community. And we have a very diverse city with a lot of points of view that need to be reconciled. But I think you'll see at the end of the day that the mayor and the council do the things that are in the best interest of the community.
You've worked for the city for a very long time. It's been talked about how you started out as an intern. Do you think that your appointment now as city manager sends any kind of message to young people, either who are currently working in city government or people who are thinking about getting into city government?
Well, that's a great question. I hope it sends a signal that people can make a meaningful career in serving the public in public service. That's what I've tried to do, and we have a lot of great employees here, and we've got a great crop of young and dynamic employees, and yes, I hope it's motivating and encouraging to them to continue to work for the city and that there are opportunities in working for the city if you're committed to serving the public.
Do you expect that the way Mr. Cavazos left the city and sort of all that happened and was discussed leading up to his departure and post will have in any way impact your negotiations?
Oh, of course. I think the whole conversation nationwide and in our city about pensions and all those sorts of things have an impact on it. And the mayor and council and I have all agreed that we will have a non-spiking contract. And so that's already influencing the nature of what we're going to work on.
Ed Zuercher, Phoenix's new city manager. Ed, thanks.
Thanks so much.
This week, Google announced that Scottsdale, Phoenix, and Tempe could be among the next cities to have Google Fiber. The Valley is one of nine metro areas the company is looking at to potentially install its high-speed internet service, which is 100 times faster than the average broadband network. The service is currently only available in Kansas City. Pam Whiting is the Vice President of Communications for the Greater Kansas City Chamber of Commerce.
There was tremendous excitement when Google made the announcement. Kansas City was the first city chosen for Google Fiber, and that's been a significant advantage for us the last couple of years.
Whiting says it's too early to have numbers, but anecdotally, Google Fiber has been a boon to Kansas City.
We saw tremendous interest from all over the country the minute that Google made the announcement that they were bringing their first high-speed network to Kansas City, and it continues.
Do you have Google Fiber?
You know, I'm not lucky enough to have it yet. There's a lot of infrastructure investment. It takes a little time. They roll it out slowly into different fiberhoods, they call them. I don't have it. I live on the outskirts of the city. But the good news is, last week there were a couple of guys stringing wire and putting up a new pole in front of my house, and they said they were working for Google.
Whiting says the city has seen a lot of startup and entrepreneurial activity over the past few years. One big example of that is the Kansas City Startup Village.
My name is Matthew Marcus. I am an entrepreneur and startup community advocate. I have a startup company here in Kansas City called Hoopla.io, and then also one of the co-leaders of the Kansas City Startup Village.
Marcus describes his company as the easy button for event marketing. He says the Startup Village started organically a little more than a year ago. He describes it as a mecca for startups and entrepreneurs.
There was a handful of us that kind of, you know, gravitated toward this area. It happened to be the first neighborhood in the world to get Google Fiber. And basically what happened is three separate buildings had startup activity within about a block of one another without any planning or any organization. So when we saw this activity going on, we said, hey, let's put a brand behind this and a name, and let's try to get more startups here. It'll be a great place. And so we did that. And fast forward, a year plus later, we've got 26 startups in the area and 14 properties, and it just keeps going up and up.
How much of what's gone on there do you attribute to Google Fiber being available?
I would say that definitely had a healthy dose of publicity for us. But that being said, although some people have come for Google Fiber, what they really end up staying for is the community, the energy, the excitement around the startup and entrepreneurial activity happening in Kansas City.
What was that like before Google Fiber? I mean, even, you know, before the Startup Village sort of came to being, was there sort of a culture of entrepreneurship and tech startups in Kansas City?
You know, there really was. I mean, there's been quite a few startups over the decades that have started right here in Kansas City. You can talk about Sprint, you can talk about Hallmark, you can talk about DST, H&R Block, even Garmin now. So it's been a mecca for startup activity, but considering today's kind of insight, I guess, into startup activity or how it really has thrived all around the country or around the world, Kansas City has followed suit and really created an amazing environment for the fast-paced environment of startups and entrepreneurs.
How important is it to startups like yours to have this, by all accounts, ridiculously fast internet?
You know, it depends. It depends on the startup. And what's interesting is we, being the first to get this service, find ourselves in a unique position and with a unique opportunity of being the first to kind of to capitalize upon it. You know, we have this window of opportunity to say, hey, this is definitely going to roll out, but we're the first to get it. So how are we going to capitalize on that? the majority of the startups in the village don't really rely on the gigabit per second speeds for their startups to be successful, simply because their ideas existed before even Google announced they were coming. And that being said, there's been quite a few initiatives in Kansas City to help startups, help entrepreneurs think outside the box, innovate with this gigabit in mind, and come up with solutions, products, and services that will eventually be able to roll out, across the country / world, and we can say, hey, it happened here in Kansas City.
So are you concerned that as Google Fiber ends up in more cities, Austin and Provo, Utah are, seems like the next two to get it, are you concerned that maybe you'll lose some of your entrepreneurial edge?
Honestly, we've heard this question a few times, and really the answer is no, simply because there's so much that makes a startup community or city successful beyond just having one awesome technical resource. And actually, it'll only help us because to be the only city with this service means you can't really spread your products and services that you create to other places. We really want other cities to get the service so we can start collaborating.
Matthew Marcus is an entrepreneur and co-leader with the Kansas City Startup Village. Barry Broom also hopes Phoenix, Scottsdale, and Tempe get Google Fiber. He's the president and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council and says it would be a great recruiting tool he could use to lure companies to the valley.
Telecommunications has been driving most of our information communication technology performance. So adding this to our region's capability is going to be really important, very positive.
How significant is it to you that Scottsdale, Phoenix, and Tempe are working together on this?
Communities do one of two things, either coordinate or they fight. There's no in-between. They're not incidental. So watching those three mayors work together, I think, is very important. And our mayors in this region have done a great job at collaborating together on the economy.
Do you foresee more partnerships like this, not necessarily with these three specific Valley cities, but with any combinations of other Valley cities to bring in opportunities like this?
Infrastructure is usually in areas that are most dense. So whether it's air service or fiber optics, you're going to see this kind of investment primarily in the urban core. But what all these mayors do really well together is they're working together on a new metropolitan business plan called Velocity. So I think you're going to see more strategic planning by the mayors in the future, and you're going to see that at a market level, and that's going to be good news for jobs. It's also going to be a very efficient and productive way to manage public dollars. When cities compete with each other, they waste public dollars and they get themselves in trouble.
Barry Broom, President and CEO of the Greater Phoenix Economic Council. Barry, thanks.
Thank you.
And Google will be working with leaders in Phoenix, Scottsdale, and Tempe on potential plans for the new service. Still to come, water experts say the Southwest should get used to the idea of drinking recycled water.
And if you analyzed it, you would discover that it is every bit as pure as the stuff you pay $1.79 a liter for, at the grocery store.
Water, well, you know the rest. It's ahead on the show. Pretty smooth sailing on Valley Freeways for you right now. The only problem is an accident on the side of the road, I-10 westbound at 43rd Avenue. We're looking for partly sunny skies for the rest of this afternoon and a high of 79 degrees. Partly sunny skies over the weekend as well with highs in the lower 80s. Right now, partly sunny, 74 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by the Arizona Community Foundation, offering flexible tax-advantaged giving options for Arizonans to support the causes that speak to their hearts on the web at azfoundation.org.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
And I'm Mark Brody. So if you're already significantly in debt, and Americans who took out loans to go to college hold about $1 trillion in student loan debt, why would you ever want to take out a home mortgage?
This is Courtney Rohde from Seattle, Washington. My husband and I both got our bachelor's degree 3 years ago and graduated with a combined $50,000 of student loan debt. Since then, we've prioritizing trying to pay off our loans, especially the ones with 6% interest rate, over investing in the market or our 401ks. We still have about $35,000 to pay off, which has pushed off either of us pursuing a master's or an MBA, and we also won't be saving for a while for a down payment on a house until we can pay off more of our loans.
Ouch. The Mortgage Bankers Association says loan applications for home purchases have slipped nearly 20% in the past 4 months compared with the same period a year ago. And David Stevens, chief executive of the Mortgage Bankers Association, joins us. David, welcome.
Hi, John.
We've been asking this question. Does all this student debt constitute a break on the economy and the home mortgage industry? Are you noticing this 20% slippage might be due to student loan debt and decisions made on the basis of it?
Yeah, it's hard to draw the exact correlation, but let me just put it to you this way. First-time home buyers are run typically at about 40% of total purchases. In the last 2 years, they've actually averaged below 30%. So we're seeing a clear lack of activity in first-time home buyers entering the marketplace. And the one variable we look at is the debt structure. Aggregate debt levels in this country are actually dropping. There's been a slight uptick in auto loans reflecting the strength of the industry. But otherwise, they've been dropping except for student loan debt, which has grown from about $250 billion in 2003 to near $1 trillion now in total debt. That adds an enormous weight on young people exiting college who may be wanting to, at some point in the near term, once they get established in a job, to be able to buy a home. And we see it in the actual debt levels of college graduates versus other households.
And the irony, and I speak to you now as a former FHA commissioner for the Obama administration, which you were, you know, during a time of recession, people going back to school and taking out loans to go back to school constitutes a kind of stimulus in the sense that people are trying to upgrade their you know, employability to be able to get back into the workforce. But the debt is a kind of counter-cyclical break on the economy. So what you gain in stimulus sending people back to school, you lose in their buying power when they get out.
That's absolutely right. And you can take this and multiply the effect in many different ways. It affects the move-up home purchase market. So it has a broader impact on the housing market, which is, you know, roughly 40 basis points of the GDP. If first-time homebuyers don't enter, the people who own those homes can't move on to the next home. Likewise, in the rental community, as you well know, in places like New York City and other urban markets where young people tend to find their first jobs in higher percentages in any case, it creates rent inflation. And that disrupts families who are likely longer-term renters who may actually be forced out of their homes and have to move out to more remote locations because the supply and demand effect on the rental housing. So the imbalance affects families, and it affects the economy. And it's
I'm sketching here on the back of a napkin. We just got about a minute. It seems to me that if the federal government forgave, or somebody forgave, about, you know, $250 billion in student loans, that might be the best stimulus for the Mortgage Bankers Association.
Well, look, the two things we know. One, we don't want to put people into unsustainable environments and buying, you know, talking them into buying a home when they're not ready. So the borrowers have to be ready. But when they are, you know, this has a hangover effect. I think it's an extraordinary challenge for policymakers. You've heard some members of Congress raise this as a significant issue. I think the noise around this subject needs to get louder.
David Stevens, chief executive of the Mortgage Bankers Association and former FHA commissioner for the Obama administration. Thanks, David.
Thanks, John.
That's The Takeaways, John Hockenberry. A new production of writer Samuel Hunter's The Whale has landed in Tempe. Theater critic Robert Pala takes us there.
With The Whale, Ron May and Damon Deering have combined forces. May as director at his own Stray Cat Theater, Deering in the lead of this marvelously complicated play. Together they've turned out the must-see production of the season. Samuel Hunter's story about a morbidly obese man seeking redemption at the end of his life has had other, more high-profile productions in the recent past, at Chicago's Victory Gardens, for example, and New York's Playwright Horizons. But not having seen them, I didn't find myself holding back tears at those productions. In A Fat Suit, Deering plays the beleaguered title character, Charlie, a distance learning professor who teaches expository writing from the filthy sofa on which he's marooned in Eric Beck's smartly dreary set. He bribes his mean-spirited teenage daughter, played by a darkly comic Michelle Chin, to spend time with him during these last days of his life. The pair meet and ultimately save a young Mormon missionary, played guilelessly by Austin Keeley, and are harangued by a woman named Liz, in a neatly calibrated performance by the dependable Anne-Marie Falvey. She loves Charlie, in spite of his refusal to care for himself, and his endless litany of sputtered apologies. Deering says he was changed by doing this play.
It's really more that the decision to do this play changed me. I really felt that the only way to do Charlie justice was to be really honest about some of the things that have gone on in my life and act them. And that is not something I'm used to. In order to do it, I sort of have to lay myself bare, and that is not something I'm used to doing.
Deering avoids scenery chewing and reveals the fragility behind this dying man's histrionics. No easy task when you're acting in a fat suit. No actress less estimable than Johanna Carlyle could turn up late in the second act of a play this well-built and shift focus from a cast this strong. She does. The scene in which Carlyle encounters her wretched ex-husband after 15 years, her face registering pity, love, revulsion, is an entire acting class in itself, a primer of how to emote brilliantly all the way to the cheap seats. The terrific beauty of this stunning production's final moments belong not to Carlyle or Deering or to the rest of this exquisite and hardworking cast, but to lighting designer Ellen Bone, who depicts death as a stylish period on a story that demands our attention and, moreover, deserves it. For KJZZ, I'm Robert Pala.
The Whale continues through March 1st at the Tempe Performing Arts Center. Robert Pala's writing appears each week in Phoenix New Times. It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Matthew Wetzel, and I'm out skateboarding at Union Hills. I've been doing this since I was 10. It's something you figure out. You kind of get into the state where you're just purely instinctual, and you just kind of go. It's a social thing, just like anything else. It's you have something in common, and people help each other out. They'll tell you what you're doing wrong skateboarding and help you get better. It's awesome.
That's Matthew Wetzel skateboarding at Union Hill Skate Park in Glendale. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix sound unique, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org. Still to come, a piece of Arizona history is on the auction block.
We've seen folks that want to use it as a religious retreat. We've seen folks who want to revitalize it as a resort.
The story of the Castle Hot Springs Resort is ahead. It's the show. Pretty nice weekend on the way for the Phoenix area. Look for partly sunny skies the rest of this afternoon with a high of 79. Overnight lows tonight near 50, then highs tomorrow and Sunday in the lower 80s. Right now, partly sunny, 74 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Gateway Airport in Mesa, serving 35 destinations, including Oakland and Bellingham, off the 202 Empower Road in the East Valley with freeway access to the rest of the valley. Details at justplaineasy.com.
Safeway could be putting itself up for sale. The California-based grocery chain is the second biggest in the country and has more than 100 stores in Arizona. Retail analyst Bert Flickinger has an idea of who might be interested in potentially buying Safeway.
Odd time favorite would be Cerberus, which has a big investment in super value retail, which includes Albertsons in the West Coast, in Western U.S., in addition to Acme, Shaw, and Star Markets in the East Coast, and jewel stores in the Central U.S. And this may be a way for super value retail and Cerberus to get some synergies because Safeway and Kroger Fries have been doing much, much better than Safeway corporate retail has with consumers.
So in a market like Phoenix, which has Albertsons grocery stores, that would be more of a consolidation than anything else, right?
It would definitely be a consolidation where Safeway is growing, expanding, remodeling its stores in the greater Phoenix, Maricopa, and Arizona statewide market quite successfully, as Fry's is continuing to do the same and grow quite successfully. And Albertsons is largely gone sideways. Their two key supermarket sector competitors have fared much better with Arizona consumers.
So would you expect then that all the current Safeway stores theoretically would stay open? Do you think there might be some closures if Safeway and Albertsons become one company?
It would be likely that if Albertsons and Safeway combined in Arizona that some of the stores would close, probably more of the Albertsons stores than Safeway, because Safeway stores tend to be up to date in terms of CapEx, capital expenditures, and remodeling and renovating, and Albertsons is further behind in CapEx.
What kind of impact, if any, do you think this kind of deal would have on the Phoenix grocery store market, which, as we've discussed in the past, is fairly competitive?
The Phoenix grocery market is very competitive. It would make a combination of two companies more competitive, even if that second company were not Albertsons, because the combined companies would have more procurement power. More procurement power typically leads to lower prices for consumers, and with lower prices in every key category in the store, shoppers and the Phoenix and Greater Arizona market respond to lower everyday prices and respond to powerful promotional prices when there are deep discounts.
Bert Flickinger is Managing Director of Strategic Resource Group, a consumer industry consultancy specializing in retail. Since we're all getting older, let's tick off another item on the Phoenix bucket list. We're teaming up with Robert Pala and Amy Silverman of New Times on the list of things you've got to do in Phoenix before you die. Today, I'm meeting Amy in Paradise Valley and kind of stepping into the Wayback Machine at Cosanti, Paolo Soleri's home and studio.
A lot of people think very highly of Frank Lloyd Wright. I do as well, and Gamage Auditorium is on the bucket list. But I actually have an even fonder spot for Paolo Soleri. I don't know how well known he is outside of the Valley and outside of artistic circles. He died last year. He was in his 90s, and this was his studio. And he had a really kind of amazing and weird utopian vision for society. Basically, the idea that he had was that we should not have urban sprawl, which didn't even exist as he knew it in the 50s when he came to Phoenix to apprentice for Frank Lloyd Wright. He basically thought people should live on top of one another. And that's what Arcosanti is. And you can actually go out there and spend the night there, and that's on the bucket list as well. But I think coming to Cosanti and buying someone a bell as a wedding gift or some other gift is truly a Phoenix tradition, way more so than Arcosanti.
So have you bought people bells here?
Not for a while. It's become a little bit cliched, to be honest with you. But when people come from out of town, they always want to come here and look at the bells. And the really cool thing is that the foundry is still in operation, and they're still making these bronze cast bells, which supported Soleri and his followers and their vision.
So looking around, I mean, this kind of looks like, I mean, I guess this kind of looks like the 1970s, like what you stereotypically think of as the 1970s.
It totally does. It is completely funky chicken out here. And what I love about it is that it reminds me of the 1970s that I grew up in Phoenix and Scottsdale. And when you would come out to Paradise Valley, there wouldn't be much more than this and maybe a few old houses. Now there are a lot of gigantic, expensive, tacky mansions, and somehow preserved in the middle of all of it is Cosanti. And so for me, turning into the parking lot is like turning into 1976. And it must be because I came here on field trips. It's kind of spaceship looking, and there are these weird structures and shacks everywhere, and a tunnel that we can just considered walking through and decided not to.
So tell me a little bit about when you would come here as a kid. What was it like? What was the vibe here like?
It was exactly like this. Time has totally stopped. I remember there were young people scurrying around making the bells. Yeah, I remember thinking, oh, these were Paolo Soleri's followers, and they all had this amazing vision, because it was the 70s and it was okay to have a vision. It didn't mean that there was anything wrong with you. And I always wanted to buy a bell.
Was it considered at the time kind of a thing to have a Soleri bell in your house?
Oh, I think it still is. I mean, I think that people are still buying them up for weddings.
A quick note and a lesson here. The noise you hear behind Amy is what happens when you conduct an interview at a bell foundry.
When you came here now, what sort of went through your mind as you turned in the parking lot, as you're sort of walking through the place?
Oh, it's just sort of like an ah, you know, like that, just that feeling of something that is so nostalgic, so reminiscent of your childhood. It's not like I hung out here a lot and ran around making bells or anything, but to me, it's just this quintessential Phoenix moment that I remember from my childhood, and this idea of this kind of mysterious, much older Italian man who had all of these big thoughts, and that he was thinking of here in Paradise Valley, because as a kid, that there wasn't a lot of that going on. It was all going on in other places.
Amy Silverman at Cosanti in Paradise Valley, one of the items on her Phoenix bucket list. We'll be visiting spots on the list over the next few weeks.
Mesa is calling on its residents to use technology to help get their neighbors more engaged in city government. As part of the Code for America program, the city is holding a Code Across event tomorrow. Ian Linson is with the City of Mesa.
Code Across is an event that has been organized by Code for America annually. And really the idea is to bring together civic-minded people, so residents, business leaders, really anybody that's interested in coming up with innovative, creative ideas to help their communities using technology and the web.
And how does this play in with Mesa's participation in Code for America?
It's key, because actually we have three Code for America fellows that are actually living here this month, working with us throughout the rest of the year. And they're trying to come up with innovative ideas for citizen engagement through the web. And the event on Saturday helps to bring in more community members and make them a part of the conversation. And in fact, the idea would be to create a group of folks that's interested in continuing the fellows' mission after this year and on into the future.
So what kinds of things do you think might come out of an event like what you're doing on Saturday?
In past events, they actually have had the beginnings of certain applications come out of the day. Now, here in Mesa, we really want to just start the conversation and get people interested and excited in civic participation, civic engagement, and just show what's really possible now with technology and government, and show that you can make interacting with government fun. You can make it intuitive, and you can make it easy.
So why is technology, in your mind, such a good tool for getting people interested in government? And why will people care about city government with technology on their side as opposed to without it?
You know, I think it's because technology is all around us. We all use it. Many of us have mobile devices. It's an easy and convenient way to get access to the news and entertainment. And so why shouldn't government also be included in that list? And it's intuitive for many people, and it can be more exciting for many people.
From Mesa's perspective, what's the best case scenario coming out of both the Code Across event and the much longer Code for America process?
Well, really, it's to get the community more engaged and provide tools that make it easier to interact with government and get people excited.
Ian Linson with the City of Mesa. The Code Across event is from 9 to 5 tomorrow at ThinkSpot at the Red Mountain Library in Mesa. Most people are squeamish about the notion of consuming recycled wastewater, but experts say we might have to get used to the idea, given our current drought and the growing population in the Southwest. KJZZ's Laura Morales reports on how wastewater in Las Vegas gets clean enough to drink.
In Las Vegas, all the water that cleans the dishes, hits the shower drain, or is flushed down the toilet is recycled at this plant. The waste flows through 2,000 miles of pipes to arrive in a torrent here. Jeff Mills is the assistant manager.
What you're standing on right now, this is where everything comes in.
Mills holds up a plastic container of what's called influent, the waste piped into the plant.
If you take a look at it, it's not probably as dark as what you might think, because 99.9% has carrier water, basically bringing it down the collection system.
Wait, so, take your picture with it?
Sure. Definitely not a glamour shot, right?
Mills takes me through step by step how everything is filtered out: eggshells, coffee grounds, and sludge. He explains how the good bacteria eat up chemicals harmful to the environment, and finally, how ultraviolet light bulbs disinfect the water. Water pollution control laws in the 1940s and 50s provided federal money to build wastewater treatment plants like this one. Much of that water is now reused on golf courses, in air conditioners, and car washes. In some cases, it flows back into the environment, like the Las Vegas Wash.
If you kind of come in and the fish don't see you, you should see a good half dozen good-sized carp.
Oh.
Yeah, there's one right there.
Wow. They're big.
Yeah, they are big.
From the Las Vegas Wash, the water flows 25 miles downstream to Lake Mead, a massive reservoir that supplies water to Southern California and Arizona. But the recharge won't do much to bolster Lake Mead. It's so low, the Southern Nevada Water Authority is building a new pipe to pump water to Las Vegas. Engineering project manager Erica Moonen takes me to a platform where I can look down a 600-foot deep shaft that's 30 feet in diameter.
Whoa!
Warm, humid air mists up my camera lens and my glasses. Moonen says they're building this pipeline to take cleaner water from the bottom of the lake.
That treated wastewater gets trapped at the surface. So if we're deep enough, it doesn't really influence. We don't see the influence of that treated wastewater coming in and into our intakes.
Some water experts worry about what the wastewater treatment plants don't remove. Traces of pharmaceutical drugs, for instance. Robert Glennon is the author of Unquenchable, America's Water Crisis and What to Do About It.
Now, they're in exceedingly small doses measured in the parts per trillion, but they're still powerful chemicals, and we don't know what the maximum safe exposure level is for any one of these chemicals, never mind that it's really a veritable cocktail mix of chemicals.
So far, research shows no harmful health impacts in places like Namibia, where people are already drinking recycled water without an environmental buffer like a lake. But more studies need to be done. In the meantime, Glennon says that water can be used on parks or to wash cars.
When most of us think about the water that we have, we think of it as though it were like air, infinite and inexhaustible, when for all practical purposes, it's very finite and very exhaustible.
That's why the Southwest is relying more and more on recycled water to stretch the supply. Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
Tuna in the Gulf of Mexico, exposed to crude oil during the Deepwater Horizon spill 4 years ago, may have suffered heart damage, according to new research. Scientists from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration studied heart muscle in tuna and found exposure to crude oil compounds affected cell function, leading to irregularities and even heart failure. The BBC's science correspondent Jonathan Amos reports.
Economically, tuna is one of the most valuable fish stocks in the ocean, and the Gulf of Mexico is a hugely important spawning ground. Scientists have long known that certain chemicals in crude oil can be harmful to the hearts of embryonic and developing fish, but the mechanisms have been unclear. Now, lab experiments on tuna heart muscle have shown how crude blocks signalling in vital cellular pathways, leading to a slowing of the heart, irregularities in rhythm, and even cardiac arrest at high exposures. Significantly, these pathways operate in exactly the same way in all big animals, meaning the cardiac risks faced by tuna were probably shared by many of the creatures swimming in the Gulf's polluted waters 4 years ago. And it raises questions about the impacts on human health from air that is polluted with the exhaust products from petroleum burned in motor vehicles. It could explain, say the scientists, why there are more heart attacks on days when cities experience a lot of smog.
That's the BBC's Jonathan Amos. It's referred to as the Grand Dowager of Arizona Resorts. In the late 1800s, Castle Hot Springs became a secluded getaway for the sick and the wealthy. It closed nearly 40 years ago and hasn't been much used ever since. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez was given access to the historic site before it sold to the highest bidder.
The 210-acre property northwest of Lake Pleasant is not easy to get to. The off-road drive from the Carefree Highway is slow and treacherous. Even so, Arizona historian John Southard came along for the ride.
To build something here in the middle of the desert seems as if it would be a highly improbable venture.
After 30 long minutes in the car, we can see a bright yellow structure just around the hill. It's one of two iconic buildings still standing on the property. As we approach it, Southard marvels at the resort's history.
If you think about it, the Arizona Biltmore, the Wigwam, the San Marcos and Chandler, these were all built in the 1920s. And yet here, three decades prior, you have somebody establishing a resort in an area far outside the metropolis.
Just in front of that yellow building are the Bradshaw Mountains, with peaks that resemble castle tops. That's how the resort got its name. Behind the building, nestled up on a hill, is a hot spring. An eager Southard treks the path. The spring has been the property's biggest asset. The water naturally heats to 118 degrees and spews hundreds of thousands of gallons of water daily. Pipes that travel down the hillside channel water to the buildings.
The property is gorgeous.
Douglas Johnson is with CBRE, the company managing the auction at the end of the month.
They've had a full-time caretaker who lives on the site, and he does a great job taking care of the property.
The caretaker works for the current owner, a foreign bank that's trying to unload the land.
We've seen folks that want to use it as a religious retreat. We've seen folks who want to revitalize it as a resort. We've seen folks who want to do rehabilitation centers. But at the end of the day, whoever the highest and best bidder is will own the property.
This is not all that comforting to historian John Southard.
It is something that makes me rather nervous to think of the changes that could be made here.
Southard says selling Castle Hot Springs to the highest bidder may lead to the resort's historical demise. He recalls that this land was first developed in the 1890s as a tuberculosis sanatorium. The hot spring was used for healing. The unique feature convinced new owners to convert it into a private getaway with tennis courts, a golf course, a hotel, and a 125,000-gallon swimming pool filled with spring water.
It was developed into a facility that could accommodate 100 people, and they could take advantage of the springs. It became really a destination for the wealthy, a retreat for some of the biggest names in American business and politics.
Including the Rockefellers, Roosevelts, and Wrigleys. Even President Kennedy stayed here after serving in the war. The resort continued through the 1950s and 60s, but a fire in 1976 shut the business down.
It's widely believed that this is the oldest resort in Arizona. Anytime a historic property goes up for sale, you hope that the next owner will be sensitive to the property's history, sensitive to its significance to the community.
In fact, the land has been for sale for several years, but so far no one's paid the nearly $6 million asking price. The auction next Thursday is the latest attempt to find a buyer. Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, KJZZ News, reporting from the Castle Hot Springs Resort.
10 years ago, Greg Esser says Roosevelt Row was a blighted, unsafe area. Today, it's a hub for artists, small businesses, and downtown residents. And in 10 years, he says it could be much more. Esser is vice president of the Roosevelt Row Community Development Corporation, or CDC, which released its vision for the Arts District yesterday. Esser says this vision started with a simple call for ideas at the end of 2012.
We posed the question to the community, if there's one thing you could change to make this a better community, what would that be?
The question can still be seen along the row, posted on signs directing people to fill out an online survey. They also sent out returnable postcards to residents. Esser says they got about 300 cards back and double the amount of survey responses. This turned into a checklist called Teddy's List, named after the street's namesake, Theodore Roosevelt. Teddy's List has some checks on it: plant 100 shade trees, revise the master plan for Hance Park. But there's a lot left to do. The goals are to make the area more walkable and fill it with mixed-use development.
And that can be in the form of open public spaces, more pocket parks, performance venues.
If you walk down Roosevelt Road near 3rd Avenue, you'll pass Short Leash Hot Dog Eatery, a restaurant that started out as a food truck. The downtown area was home to the food truck, and owner Brad Moore decided he wanted the permanent location to be here too.
We've gotten to know all the people that live and work and play in the area, and so it's kind of been our home since we started, and this is the area we wanted to be long term.
Keep walking past Short Leash's purple facade, and you'll see some vacant lots and empty buildings in between the small businesses. Moore says it would help the current businesses if these spaces could find tenants.
It creates a little difficulty because there's lapses in activity, so the connectivity is not always there.
Accomplishing this and other goals requires a close relationship between the public and private spheres. The City of Phoenix Office of Planning and Development says the city is already working closely with the neighborhood. City officials say big events like First Friday need their help to move heavy traffic and keep the hundreds of pedestrians safe. Sustainability advocate Leslie Lindo spearheaded the steering committee for the community survey. She says the city seems eager to listen to community input, but this only goes so far.
I would say at the end of the day, it's about what is, from their perspective, more economically feasible for the area. So it's a little bit more difficult for us with the larger development projects.
For example, many community members, such as Esser, spoke out against the proposed development of a new Circle K on 7th and Roosevelt Streets, but so far the project is still moving ahead. Still, Lindo hopes the new plan will help them accomplish long-term goals with the city.
The most important business that we need is a grocery store. I mean, that's really what's going to make it a neighborhood and keep people from having to have a car.
As more people move into the area, the CDC hopes to keep real estate affordable. One strategy is giving the owners of art spaces a tax incentive. It would work like the current property tax freeze for historic buildings that allows people to live in and care for historic homes without the worry of increasing taxes. Another idea exempts original artworks from sales tax. If you visit or live around the downtown area, you can still take the online survey, or you can view the CDC's visioning project at RooseveltRow.org. In 1539, a Spanish advance party was set to explore the Southwest. The leader of that expedition is believed to have walked through Arizona, and there are markings that many believed were made during that trip. But there are experts who say the inscription is not authentic. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez reports.
The stone inscription at South Mountain reads, Friar Marcos de Niza corona todo el Nuevo México a su costa año de 1539. It translates to Marcos de Niza crowned all of New Mexico at his expense in the year 1539. It's believed the Spanish priest inscribed them himself to mark his expedition through the valley. Did you know those markings are not authentic?
You know, there was some controversy about its authenticity, and I wanted to be able to establish its veracity.
Eduardo Pagan is a historian and an ASU professor. He's also one of three experts who were part of a PBS show, History Detectives, who researched the stone in 2009.
When we started out this investigation for History Detectives, I wanted to find out that it was true. For all sorts of reasons, right? Not only because I'm just a native Arizonan and wanted this thing to be accurate, but it would help us then pinpoint Marcos de Niza's journey.
Pagan and his fellow historians say there is no way the markings on South Mountain could have been made in 1539. They say the words New Mexico were established after the mid-1500s. Also, the carving on the stone is written Western world style, from left to write.
The more that I studied all of these inscriptions, all the way up to the 1700s, it still kept this cubic style without any spaces between letters or words. And I went back and I looked at the Marcos de Niza inscription, and it just looks so linear to me. It looks so modern.
Lastly, and the most convincing evidence, is the rock itself. Petroglyph experts tested the stone minerals within the carvings and found it predates the automobile era and post-dates the Little Ice Age, which ended in the mid-19th century. Ultimately, the inscription is a forgery. They determined the carvings were most likely made sometime after the turn of the 20th century.
So shouldn't that be preserved as well? Even though it might be a fraud, it's a historic fraud and it's a historic inscription, so it becomes a very interesting story now.
Pagan says the writing may have been carved by someone who admired Marcos de Niza and decided to pay homage to the friar. He says proving the inscription a forgery could also be proof that he never really traveled through the Sonoran Desert. The Marcos de Niza stone inscription has been protected behind iron bars since it was discovered in the 1920s as a way to keep vandals from destroying it. Interestingly, that in that same area are authentic Hohokam petroglyphs. Pagan says they're easily thousands of years old. Yet those petroglyphs are not protected, and there are signs they've been vandalized. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
Did you know that we want to hear from you? We hope you know that. Send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org. Internationally acclaimed conductor Tito Munoz has been appointed to the new Virginia G. Piper Music Director of the Phoenix Symphony. Munoz was a guest conductor with the symphony for two seasons. He says he's looking forward to a position in the U.S.
I got to say, I'm super excited, as you can imagine. It's a big step. It's the first music directorship of an American orchestra, and a prominent one at that. The Phoenix Symphony does have quite a good reputation all around the country, and it's very exciting for me. You know, and the both weeks that I've been to Phoenix to work with the orchestra and to see the city and get to know the people, it's just given me more and more a desire to be there and take the position.
A native of New York, Munoz was serving as music director in France. He starts work in September. Among the events going on around town this weekend, Spring Training Festival on Saturday at Scottsdale Civic Center. There's also the International Sportsman's Exposition Friday through Sunday at University of Phoenix Stadium in Glendale, and the Peach Blossom Festival through Sunday at Schneff Farm in Queen Creek. The show was produced this week by John Hoban, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez, with help from Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Greer and Julie Levin make up our digital team. Our managing editor is Al Macias, and our news director is Peter O'Dowd. I'm Mark Brody. Steve Goldstein should be back next week. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD at 3 o'clock.